Welcome to the GeoMob Podcast, where we discuss geo-innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit.
Hello, and welcome back to the GeoMob Podcast. In this episode, we're talking about the Copernicus data space ecosystem. And Rash is with me to discuss all of the essential ins and outs on this topic and to guide you and me through it all. And Rash, welcome. And maybe we can start with you introducing yourself to the listeners, letting us all know a little bit about your background and what you're currently working on.
Hello, nice to meet you. I'm Andrzej Śliński. I work at Synergize, which is one of the contractors for the Copernicus data space ecosystem. My job title is community evangelist, so actually my role is to communicate, to promote, to provide scientific outreach about the data space. My background, I'm actually trained as a conservation biologist, and I worked a lot in limnology, which is the science of open waters. And my main topic was wetlands, and if you've ever worked in a wetland, then you know that you're really grateful for anything you can do with remote sensing instead of getting very wet and muddy. So I've been through all sorts of remote sensing data, from historic aerial photographs to hyperspectral data to airborne laser scanning. And then we started upscaling to larger areas, to nationwide laser scanning. And then I moved on over to industry, to agriculture monitoring, and that was done with Sentinel data as one of the contractors for the Hungarian cap monitoring. And meanwhile, sort of as a side job, first I started working in science communication, and I also did a brief stint with policy decision support. And so all this ended up with me working now for Copernicus Data Space Ecosystem as the main communication and outreach person.
Cool. Thank you very much. So as a total aside to what we're going to be talking about on the episode, like the change between limnology and agricultural monitoring, was that a fairly easy change to make, or was there quite a lot of learning to be made when you started the agricultural monitoring?
I had to learn a lot about agriculture, and I really enjoyed it because it was like a conscious thing that I have to absorb all this knowledge. I have to talk to farmers. I have to talk to agricultural remote sensing people. I even went back to basic university level textbooks about how to farm cereals and vegetables. And all that was really exciting, seeing the other half of, you know, what I used to approach from the conservation or the water quality side.
Brilliant. Now, there's a whole episode all of its own, I'm sure, around that and the work that you were doing in wetlands and in agriculture. But anyway, we're here to talk about the Copernicus data space ecosystem. I was wondering if you could maybe just dive a little bit into the data available through the ecosystem portal, maybe highlight what some of the special and unique data are that are on there, and you know, maybe point out as well why people would want to come to this portal over others.
Well, Copernicus Data Space Ecosystem is the official data access portal and the official cloud computing infrastructure for Sentinel data. So actually anybody else who's distributing Sentinel data is getting it from us. So this is the first place where the data gets published. This is where all the official quality control and traceability takes place. So this is the main infrastructure for this. And this also means that it's a publicly owned thing. It's not a for-profit data platform governed by a large or a small company or a local government. This is here to stay because it's governed by a long-term service level agreement between the European Commission and us, which makes sure about the service quality and what we're offering. So this is sort of a solid thing that's going to stay here. Actually, to give an example, I recently opened a paper about mapping all the palm oil plantations in the world in a very prestigious journal. And the paper listed an online map which was done on one of the sort of commercial big open data platforms. And the paper was from 2021, but the online map was not working already, because the commercial provider changed something, and they probably can keep up with updating. Now, that's not going to happen on Copernicus Data Space Ecosystem. So this is the portal that you would start with, and it also has the closest integration of virtual machine processing capacity and data storage. So this is the new thing compared to the Copernicus Open Science Hub, that it's not only about downloading data, but processing data on the cloud, on the very machines which also host the data, and with a code base which is designed for these tasks. So this is the portal. And the data we have is all Sentinel data that ever collected over land. Again, compared to the previous version where you would have a two-year instantly available data set and everything else would be from the rolling archive. Now we have all the data instantly available. So you can even go back in time and request the data and you're getting it right away. But we are also serving Copernicus contributing missions data. We're serving a couple of downstream data products like Sentinel-3 level 2 vegetation properties or water quality maps. We are working on the ongoing integration with Copernicus services, and we have a couple of data products of our own which are only available here. These are the quarterly Sentinel-2 cloudless mosaics and the monthly Sentinel-1 mosaics. And so these are sort of machine learning ready data where the integration of the individual images, the noise correction, the cloud correction is already done. This is something that you could take as a stack and directly hand over to a machine learning algorithm.
Okay. And so, sorry if I missed it in what you were saying, but does the entire archive of Sentinel exist through this platform in some way or another? If you wanted to access, I don't know, a Sentinel 2 image from 2017 or something, is that, would you come here first in order to get at that sort of data?
Yes, it's directly there. It's immediately there, so you don't have to wait for it to get zipped or bundled or packaged in any way. It's there to access. The technical revolution behind this is actually uncompressed data storage or uncompressed data formats. We're not that worried about data volume anymore. So it's possible to store data in formats such as the cloud-optimized GeoTIFF, where you can actually perform a spatial query as part of the data download, and you're not downloading a tile or a pre-designated block of data. You are only accessing the very area of interest, the small area of interest that you want to look in, and nothing else. And additionally, as part of your request, you can specify the subset of data, the data bands or the quality filters, and even the operation that should be done on the data before you download. So if you're, for example, looking for NDVI, you don't even need to download the near-infrared and the red band separately and then do the calculation on your machine. As part of your request, you tell the machine that you want NDVI, it's calculated for you, and that's the only thing you get. So this is really reducing the volume of data we move. We like to say, you know, people think a good data infrastructure is something that moves a lot of data. No. A good data infrastructure is something that saves you moving a lot of data and only gives you what you want.
Yeah. Okay, cool. excuse me. How does this sit with commercial offerings? Because I know there's a whole host of existing platforms or ways of accessing Sentinel data, some of which might be restricted in the length of time that you can go back and get data, or maybe restricted in terms of where you're getting data from. It sounds like this is the go-to place now and into the future for all Sentinel products. Is that correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Actually, the free access and processing quota is already pretty large. So I know about the provider who is doing agricultural monitoring across all of Hungary using just the free quota. And so this means if you want to build a business, you can definitely start with the free quota. You can get your customers, you can start serving people without investing a single cent in buying a server. And then the data space actually ports onto the commercial service of Copernicus data space ecosystem, which is called CreoDIAS. This is a commercial virtual machine provider, but the trick is that all the code that you can build on the data space will work just the same on CreoDIAS. All the dependencies, all the libraries, all the data collections are structured in the very same way. I mean, physically, it's actually the same infrastructure. So if you run out of quota, it's very easy to switch to the commercial system. Or the other way around, if you're building a commercial solution, but you decide for some reason that you want to open this up, it's very easy to serve the code or to serve the data products for free in the ecosystem.
Okay, yeah. So it was interesting that you mentioned CreoDIAS there. So I remember that as a DIAS system. So how does this data ecosystem differ from the DIAS platforms? Have they merged or are they totally different?
Well, some of them have merged because CreoDIAS has existed before Copernicus data space ecosystem. Some of them are going on because they have either a code base or a user base which is focused for some reason and it's keeping them alive. And some DIASes are discontinued. They are not functioning anymore or they are not funded anymore, either from the commission or from their national providers. It seems that the idea that was the starting point for the DIAS is that we need to replicate the data and create local hubs to serve it in a couple of places across the continent this is gone. We don't need to do that anymore because we can stream data so fast.
Okay. So basically, it seems like the advances in cloud computing have totally transformed the way in which people are going to be accessing data, computing the products that they want, and all of that sort of thing.
Exactly. I mean, one of my happiest days as a postdoc was when I got my first project grant, and the first thing I bought was a gamer laptop, right? That's what you buy. And I was very happy about it. It was a very pretty laptop. And now you don't need that anymore. There's no reason to buy a very powerful computer if you want to work with Sentinel data and Earth observation. And I think for startups, that's a massive difference.
Yeah, yeah. So what sort of tools exist on the platform for data analysis? Like, if I was to come along, what would I be looking for that I might want to use?
Well, the main toolkit is called APIs, Application Programming Interfaces. So for those of you who don't know what this is a communication language between the code on your computer and the code on our backends. It allows you to exactly tell the backend what to do. And different API families exist. Some of them are very closely integrated with our visualization tools, like Sentinel Hub. Others are more complicated to use because they have a lot of possibilities and they are also compatible with other data repositories, such as OpenEO. And these are the tools that you would use to set up your workflow, which is designed to run on the cloud, on our cloud, and then give you the results or even the resulting statistics. Typically, you would want to do this on Jupyter. And we have a dedicated Jupyter lab where you can spawn a small virtual server, which already has the dependencies installed. It directly connects to the data storage. And this is where you can start experimenting. And experimenting means processing terabytes of data or looking at continental scale time series. And you can do this for free inside the hub. And if you want to do something that grows out of that hub, you can take your code and run it on a larger scale. But for people who are not really into coding, we also have a tool. We have the Copernicus browser. This is a graphical interface to all these APIs or to the Sentinel Hub API family where anybody can look at the satellite images in a web browser, even on a smartphone. And you can perform simple analysis tasks such as looking at time series or creating a graphical animation, things like this, which in the backend are sending the commands to the API. But what you see is just that you can create a time series graph, or you can download an image, or you can create a comparison of two images and sort of interact with the data, all the data sets, in this very intuitive way.
That's really interesting. So I'd come across the Copernicus browser, but it hadn't registered in my mind that actually that integrates directly with the data service and ecosystem here, and that's how it's working. That's really useful to know. So are you saying if someone turned up and they wanted to use, say, Sentinel-1 data, Sentinel-2 data, and Sentinel-5 data in some application, they could spin up a Jupyter notebook and then start to basically pull in data and process it through code written in that notebook? Is that sort of the way it's designed to work?
Yes, exactly. That's how it's designed to work. And then since it's a Jupyter notebook, you would be able to interactively look at the results inside the notebook. You could fine-tune things. You could change your area of interest and run the same code. And actually, for some APIs, it's even possible. Actually, for both major families, for both the Sentinel Hub API family and OpenEO, it's then possible to publish your algorithm in Sentinel Hub as a custom script or an eval script, where the actual data processing part can be published on a GitHub repo and made available to everyone. For OpenEO, we have what's called an algorithm plaza. It's really sort of an online shop where, of course, most of the resources are for free, but you create a process, you define it, and then that model can be served to other people who can run it on their same, on their area of interest or their data sets.
Okay, cool. Would you be able to maybe just say a little bit more about OpenEO and the types of processes and things that can be done with OpenEO? It sounds really as if it's tightly integrated with the whole platform.
Yes. Well, OpenEO is really revolutionary because it deals away with a lot of the boundaries of Earth observation. You're not limited to one single coding language. You're not limited to one single data format. It has its own data cube format. So all the data that it uses is ingested in there. and then all the different band combinations or time series analysis steps or heavy machine learning classifications or biophysical models are all possible inside the API, since the data is set up in a way to be compatible with it. And it also has its own way of storing the actual process. So OpenEO has more than 100 different mathematical functions that you can do on the data sets, from very simple things like average of a time series to really complex ones like random forest. And using these building blocks, these modules, you can build a pipeline. You can even do it in a visual interface, but of course you would probably want to do it in code and then maybe tweak it in the visual interface. And then this process, this model, is also stored in OpenEO's own language in the form of this process graph. And the nice thing is that OpenEO itself can then output the code in a different language. You can write something in R and share it with somebody who likes to work with Python. And I think that's really making a difference. It's not going to be perfect code, but this conversion is possible. And again, this is helping a lot with interoperability and transferability. And the OpenEO API, I mean, that existed already before Copernicus Dataspace. It's completely open code. So it's very well documented. It's really built to support the FAIR principles of findability and repeatability and interoperability and accessibility. Yes, those are the letters. So if you build something in OpenEO, people will really be able to use it. And the compatibility is not restricted to the Copernicus Dataspace backend. So anything which is stored in a stack compliant format, whether on your computer or the server of your friend or some other open data provider, will be directly available in OpenEO. So you can really access a lot of the data and build something very complex.
That's really interesting. So interesting as well that you mentioned the data queue, because obviously there's some very, within Earth observation, some very famous examples of data cubes, such as the African data cube and over in Australia as well. The ability to create data cubes, I think, would be really useful. And so you're saying that using OpenEO, that's a relatively trivial thing to do? I mean, if you understand how to write the code and you understand the structure of the data, it sounds like it's supported out of the box.
Yes. I mean, there are really a lot of modules there, and most typical Earth observation analysis pipelines you would be ready to build by creating a chain of these individual modules or these individual functions. But you can also create a user-defined function. So it's possible to define a new module where the data access part, the backend connection, is taken care of by OpenEO, and any Python or R code would just run as that function. And then it would output, again, the results in an OpenEO compatible format. And this is how really complex biophysical models or radiative transfer models or hardcore machine learning can be directly built into OpenEO. And again, you can run this without downloading the data to your own server on the cloud capacity of the data space.
And is machine learning seen as a key application for the ecosystem and the platform, or is it more about data discovery, or is it basically just you're going to provide all of the tools and all of the data, and it's totally up to the users as to what becomes the most heavily sort of used application area on the system?
No, machine learning is definitely a core application. We see what machine learning is doing with Earth observation data and all the different possibilities. Of course, you will need to have a high quantity and high quality of reference data. It's always coming down to the reference data if it's machine learning. But the platform itself will take very complex machine learning algorithms. Most of them are not served directly. We have random forest and a couple of other gradient boosted trees, a couple of simple algorithms. And if you are building a notebook, it's possible to install your own dependencies, even on your own little Jupyter server. Yeah. And then you can take whichever machine learning library you prefer and hand the data over there.
Okay. So the other thing that I'm interested in is, you were saying this is supported long-term going off into the future. So what's the sort of cycle for making sure that the libraries are up to date and sort of all of the sort of tools that you're going to need as a data analyst are the sort of most up-to-date tools that you can get?
Well, our partners are maintaining these. So OpenEO is open code, but there's a lot of professional development going into it, since it's a funded project. So mostly Vito, but also Synergize and other partners are keeping the OpenEO code up to date and releasing new modules. The Jupyter Lab is taken care of by Cloudfero, who is the cloud provider partner. And again, they are also providing virtual machines in commercial settings to companies, government agencies, whoever. And so through these connections, again, the code base is kept up to date. And that's also part of how the code base of the Jupyter Lab is kept up to date. And we have an ongoing user support system. So if you submit an error report in the forum, then our developers are going to pick it up. If there's a problem with Copernicus browser or one of the APIs gives an unusual result, it's going straight to our developers who are going to look into it. This is how Copernicus Data Space is funded. So we do have quite a budget, not just for building more and more functionality on top, but maintaining the existing functionality. The commission has been rather reasonable in recognizing the need for this, which is a very good thing.
Yes,
you know, typically, if you have a project, you're not getting a lot of money for maintaining it in the long term. Now here, long-term functionality and long-term compatibility is very much at the core of what they want from us.
Okay, well, that's really positive to know that that is the thinking behind the funding, because as you say, so often the funding gets done either for the build or just for an individual project, and then there's some sort of nebulous, or we try and make it sustainable in the long term. But it sounds like a lot of thinking has gone into actually how do we set up a system that is ready for users in the long term. So that's really good to know. I was going to ask if you could maybe say a little bit more about the two specialist products that you mentioned. I think one of them was quarterly cloud-free mosaics. I can't remember what the other one is, sorry.
Yes, quarterly cloudless Sentinel-2 mosaics and monthly Sentinel-1 mosaics. So these are created actually by very simple algorithms, but they really expand the boundary of what you see on a typical satellite image. The way this works for mosaicing is typically you would take the average value, the average pixel value within a month. We're doing something a little bit different because we're filtering out the cloudy pixels using the standard algorithm of Sentinel-2 level 2 production. And then from all the cloud-free pixels, for each individual pixel of the data set, we are taking the first quartile of the distribution of values. This is to make sure that if there's a single cloudy pixel in there, it's not going to distort the mean or the median.
Okay.
So it looks like what you would expect a cloud-free image to look like. It has red, green, blue, and near-infrared bands, these four, and it's global, and it's recreated every 3 months. In places that are extremely cloudy, like Borneo or northwestern Ireland, the quality is, of course, going to suffer. And in places where, you know, sometimes it's snowy, sometimes it's not, you might still see the boundary of where an image swath was collected. But typically, it's extremely seamless. So for viewing, actually for teaching, I really, really like it. Because for school children, you don't want to explain, you know, this is what a satellite works like. You just want to say, this is Europe, here are the Alps.
Yeah.
And then they see it. And for Sentinel-1... this also works with the monthly mean values, but there's one trick applied. The Sentinel-1 satellite is a side-looking satellite. It doesn't look downwards like at the nadir, but it sends the signals out to the sides. And this means that the resulting data product is heavily influenced by topography. And now we have applied a relatively new algorithm for cleaning out the effect of topography. We're looking at local resolution. And this means that these distortions in data intensity are removed. And radar data suffers from what is called speckle. It's not really noise, but it's the effect of the random paths of data reflection. And the process of integrating multiple images really, really cleans out the speckle. So for people who don't like radar data, looking at the monthly mosaics is a completely different experience because it's not grainy. It's not bumpy. You really, really see the properties of the surface as much as you can with radar data. You can see how the snow gets wetter before it melts. You can see changes in vegetation, of course, landslides, ships. A lot of these things are really evident. So it's visually also very beautiful, but it's a very robust data set for the fact that it's radar. And I mean, on the downstream side, the people who want to work with machine learning, that's really where you want consistent data quality. You don't want to deal with data cleaning. You might not need every single image because you're running an algorithm on it anyway. And that's where these mosaics are really powerful.
That's really interesting. So probably for almost the entirety of my career, people have been saying how they need to make radar data more understandable to people who are either involved in optical remote sensing or to people who are coming across remote sensing for the first time. So it's really, really good that you're being able to not only apply algorithms to make the data look nicer and more tidy, but actually it sounds like as well, you're using real-world applications to explain what the different sort of things, features that you can see in the image actually mean on the ground. So that's really useful. The other point that I thought was interesting is you were saying how you were using a relatively new algorithm in order to do some of the processing. Is that something that is very important to you and the project in general, is sort of making sure that you don't get locked into maybe a way of processing that's 4 or 5 years out of date, that you're constantly looking to see what the industry, by industry, I mean the wider sector, so academics as well, are generating in terms of tools and in terms of algorithms and being able to process the data in ways that are relevant for users today, using tools that are available today.
Well, yes, a lot of this is actually done at the ESA level. So ESA prepares these standard products with whatever algorithms they find useful, and then they are sent to us and stored on our infrastructure and served to users. And these are also constantly evolving. So we just recently reached the point where Sentinel-2 Collection 1 was released, which means the evolution of the processing algorithm reached a point where they said, now we're taking this algorithm and processing the archive backwards to have a standard data set. Or things like the parallax-based cloud correction, which somebody like really smartly realized you can do that with Sentinel-2 data, and then it was integrated also into the standard CentiCore processor. So this is sort of the upstream part, what you do at level one, level two level. Yeah. And on the downstream side, analysis-ready data is becoming more and more popular, and this, again, demands new algorithms. And this is coming down to the level of actual biophysical products. So now things like vegetation phenology, the steepness of the vegetation curve upslope and downslope phase, or the vegetation greenness amplitude, these products are also being served in Copernicus data space ecosystem. And of course, these products are also in constant evolution. And we are trying to understand the demand. What do farmers need? What do habitat monitoring people need? And then once we find an idea, we actually create that product. And a lot of this comes from our users. We are still continually receiving new algorithms, new custom scripts. And some of them are really interesting. And we are thinking, okay, maybe we should actually try and serve that as a product.
Yeah. No, that's... I can see how that sort of shift will be something that I think people will really take up and engage with. Talking of engagement, sort of what sorts of users are already using the data ecosystem, and sort of what types of users are you hoping to attract? So we've mentioned briefly programmers and sort of GIS specialists, but also you mentioned teachers. I think it'd be really interesting just to understand who you want to try and attract to the whole system.
Well, our main user groups are government agencies who are monitoring large areas of land. So forestry, agriculture, habitat monitoring, protected areas. And then disaster monitoring is becoming a very important application, I must say, unfortunately. But since now it's so easy to access the data, you don't necessarily need a middleman. You don't need a data processing company to create a flood map for the first responders. They can actually pull it down directly from the data space, and it's going to be quite a good flood map or a forest fire map. So these institutions are also very, very powerful users. And then we are focusing very strongly on the startup ecosystem. So this platform was created to make it very easy to do an Earth observation startup. People with good ideas can start experimenting, upscaling, and selling their product really, really quickly. And then we also have the general public, which includes school children, but this also includes NGOs. So if somebody is interested in war crimes or open source intelligence, if somebody is interested in ship spotting, or if somebody wants to get active in their local community looking at how protected areas are managed or I don't know, habitats being built up, they can very easily get free data, which is strong evidence to support their claims. And so I really like that this is a tool, you know, on one hand, it's allowing governments to monitor us more closely. But on the other hand, it's also allowing regular people to monitor government agencies or companies more closely because the data, the truth is just easier to access.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think we shouldn't underestimate the power of being able to see what is happening in the region around where you live. So I know a number of people, myself included, who got into Earth observation because of we were able to look at something that was happening locally and say, oh, look, it's changed over time, or oh, look, it's going to change or whatever. And a system like this just makes that even easier and at a larger scale. And now, I mean, with the tools you have available and the ease at which people can get in to use them, and the fact that more and more people are starting to learn languages like Python and R and what have you, I can certainly see sort of secondary school level, high school level students becoming really interested in this, which is only good, I think, for the sector. Getting more people interested in Earth observation and geospatial is always a good thing, in my view. So,
yes. I mean, my youngest son is 9 years old, and he can sit down and play around with the data in Copernicus browser. There's even a Hungarian language interface. So we are really trying to make it accessible to this level. I think one of the turning points in imagery was the, you know, remember the air pollution images of COVID?
Yeah.
Where you would see the Sentinel-5P tropomy maps of how the pollution drastically fell with the lockdowns. And I think this was really an eye-opener for a lot of people, both in the public health domain, but also for regular citizens and their transport decisions. And now we are at the level where anybody can create a map like that. It's not something that's served by ESA to the journalists. Yeah. For your particular area, you can sit down and check, okay, how has this changed in the recent 5 years or in the recent 1 year? Or, I don't know, with the opening of a new factory or a motorway.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's going to be a very powerful system, I think. So are there any limitations around cost or usage? Like you've mentioned startups. Is it, how much leeway do they get in terms of being able to use the system?
Well, it's not so easy to understand the numbers because since it's not a download-focused system, it's not like you get a certain amount of gigabytes for free download, okay, and that's your quota. The quota is actually calculated based on the amount of processing that you do, so the processing units, and the more of the processing you do on the server side, the better. That's the way to access even more data. And so the number for standard users is 40,000 processing units per month or 10,000 processing units in OpenEO that has recently been increased. But this is something that allows you to, for example, create an NDVI mosaic of the whole area of Austria for every single Sentinel-2 image that comes in. This is just a rough, over the top of my head, illustration of what this means.
That's very useful, though, to have an example of sort of in our heads what that means. That's
yes,
helpful.
Yes.
Thank you.
And if you're a public institution, if you're managing one of the public services in the EU, then you can approach the support desk for a tailor-made package, because the objective of this system is to support EU policies. So we would do all we can to give you all the capacity that you need. And if you're a startup, there's also the ESA Network of Resources project. It's a very generous funding package for startups, which can get additional commercial quota beyond what we provide to regular users funded by ESA.
Okay. Oh, that sounds like very generous levels. And sounds like there's lots of different opportunities for getting access to the data and the processing, depending on what sort of organization you are. Andras, it's been a really interesting discussion, and I definitely look forward to seeing where the whole platform and ecosystem goes and all the tools associated with it. It sounds like it's got big plans for the future, which is great. How can people get in touch with you if they need to get in touch with you?
Well, the easiest way to approach us is through the Copernicus Data Space Ecosystem Forum. We try to encourage everybody to go to the forum because then other people would see your requests or your needs. They can also jump in and help. I mean, I'm mainly responsible for communication. If you want a webinar or a presentation, then, of course, it's quite easy to find my email address through the Copernicus Data Space Ecosystem website. But otherwise, we have a YouTube channel, we have social media, and you can write to me through or to us through social media as well, on mainly on LinkedIn. And so these are the main channels to reach out. I really hope to get in touch with as many people as possible.
Yeah, no, that sounds good. Sorry, just final question, just to jump in. What sort of resources do you have on the YouTube channel? That sounds really interesting. Are they teaching types of resources, or are they sort of promotional types of resources?
There are some promotional videos, but most of them are either explanatory videos for beginners, like what is an API request or what is a data infrastructure? We have these ugly words. I think we need to explain them to people. And then we have some webinars which are specifically focusing on some domains, like how can you use satellite imagery to prepare for mountaineering? Or how can you use satellite imagery as an NGO? And then we have some really technical ones, which are guiding people through Jupyter Notebooks or the browser, explaining specific applications. How can you build a pipeline for end-to-end forest fire monitoring? How can you explore the data sets for agricultural monitoring or air quality? These are sometimes recordings of presentations we did at conferences or at training courses. Others are just dedicated recordings of these training resources. So I think at every level of skills or interests, you would find something on the YouTube channel.
Brilliant. I'm going to go and check that out after this. That sounds really fascinating. Andras, thank you again. That's been amazing.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thanks for joining us today on the GeoMob podcast. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is at thegeomob.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter and find links to our accounts on Mastodon and LinkedIn, so that you can stay up to date on all our upcoming events. We hope to see you at an event soon.